Hello and welcome to Brain Trust Live number 408.
This week on the podcast, definitely vote no on the Newsom recall, but it's okay to scream into the void while you do it.
And Democrats are actively looking to lose the Senate with their new slate of candidates.
Plus, it turns out Democrats did understand the spirit of Trump's Infrastructure Week after all.
And Andrew Cuomo becomes the latest victim of Andrew Cuomo.
Plus, the world is completely falling apart, but at least white people are on the decline.
And things not working out for 20 years in Afghanistan have surprisingly turned into a continuation of things not working out in Afghanistan.
We'll have all this and more.
This is Brain Trust Live. Hey guys, I'm Brent.
I'm Lila, and you can find us on the web at www.braintrustlive.com.
Yeah.
We're back after another gap.
Mm-hmm.
That's because last week we had the first private book party for my book.
Yeah.
A good friend threw a party for their friends for my book. That's something that anyone's able to do.
Right.
Hint,
hint. Right.
But my book comes out on the 24th, so it comes out in like a week and a half. And so we're... you know, just out there, just trying to sell this book.
Buy it.
Buy the book.
Yeah.
It's called Some Kids Left Behind, and you can buy it at every major book retailer.
That's right.
Online. I don't know what you can do.
You got another good review this week.
I got another good review. I'm getting good reviews in the trades. I'm waiting to hear about other reviews.
Yeah.
If you know someone at a major newspaper, bug them on my behalf. The Library Journal loved it.
They sure did.
Kirkus liked it, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we're out there.
Yep.
We're selling books, or not. So we don't know anything.
We'll find out.
But buy the book. It's at my website. You should just go do that.
Yes.
Also, news that we could have reported on last week, but we're reporting on this week. This recall election is getting close.
Guys.
There's so much and yet so little to say about this.
I know.
Vote no on it.
Right?
Use your heads.
Look, even DSALA the other day was like, look, we're not... happy to have to issue this statement, but just vote no on this because nobody's trying to have Larry Elder be the fucking governor of California. Like, that's just not what we're looking for. And
yeah, we gotta all use our heads here.
That's right.
One thing that this system is incredibly anti-democratic because, like it or not, we did elect Gavin Newsom to be the governor. And listen, I know that's not great. I know that there were better choices out there,
sure,
theoretically in the world.
Yeah.
But there weren't better choices on our ballot.
Nope.
And because of that, we made a choice in a voting situation,
mm-hmm,
and that was what the voters' will was, and too bad.
Yep.
But you can't just, like, decide you're going to, you know, start a small petition and then decide that the will of the voters isn't enough because a few of you got together and got a few thousand signatures on a ballot. Like, screw off.
Yeah. Well, and I thought that article that you sent about how undemocratic it is, I had never thought of it in that way. Because essentially...
Well, this frustrates me about the props, because we talk about this with the props all the time, too. Where doing an end run around the democratically elected legislature is anti-democratic.
Yeah.
That's why we always say vote no on those unless there's a very extreme circumstance.
Right.
And this is kind of the same thing.
Yeah, because ultimately, like, somebody is going to... If the recall goes through, whoever wins is going to have received less votes than Newsom would have had his name also been on the ballot. But the way our recall elections work is that it's not. You only vote yes or no on recalling Newsom, and then he's not on the ballot for you to pick from at that point. And so then whoever is the highest vote getter, but like inevitably the highest vote getter is going to have received less votes than no on the recall would have received.
Exactly. And
right?
Also, this is like a tremendous waste of money on top of everything else.
Well,
because A, all these people are welcome to run for governor on our ballot of 600 people during the regular election cycle.
Yeah.
All of these people who are trying to step in, and listen, I get it. We all hate Gavin Newsom. You know, it's rough out there. Anyone feels like they could be a better governor than Gavin Newsom. That's fine. But like every single one of these people is entitled by law to put their name on a regular ballot in a regular election year.
It's 46
and try to vote against, try to run
year.
Against
oh,
this
yeah,
guy,
right,
you know,
in a regular election,
you know, in a regular election, you can also have 46 people running.
You can.
We frequently do.
We often do. Yes.
This is not to say that these people won't get their chance. If random people, there's so many random people who would be on this ballot. First of all, Angeline is going to get to run for governor anytime she wants.
That's right.
Until she goes to pink Corvette heaven. Because Angeline is, like any American, entitled to try to petition her way onto the ballot in a regular election cycle.
Sure. Put up billboards.
We
she
are not
loves a billboard.
Infringing on the rights of any of these random people that decided they would run in the absence of Gavin Newsom. But we are infringing on the rights of the voters of California who elected him to serve a term.
That's right.
And it's too bad.
Yeah.
We just, you sometimes you have to live with your choices.
Yeah.
Because the alternatives are stupid.
Yes, I agree. We do have a public service announcement here.
Yes.
Besides the general vote no public service announcement.
And a reason that we're exceptionally angry about being stuck with this choice in the first place.
Yeah. One thing that has started to materialize this week is a lot of hand-wringing about what this recall election means for the play of a 50-50 Senate. And the reason, and if you're thinking to yourself, why the hell does the governor of California have anything to do with the 50-50 Senate right now? It's because Dianne Feinstein is fit to die at any moment.
She's on death's door.
She's on death's door. And look, I get it. That's a, like...
It's not great.
I get the hand-wringing. It's not great, right?
Yeah.
It wasn't great when the same people who are sharing those infographics on Instagram inevitably voted for her when she was fucking 86 in her last primary.
Correct.
So that is not for a lot of the left who probably, for whatever reason, is already like not super stoked on having to do this in the first place. That is not a selling point.
No.
Because first off, I need everybody who voted for her the last time around to look inward, right? We had a candidate who would have been the first Latino senator from the state of California. He was endorsed by the California Democratic Party. He was the Senate pro tem, yes, of the California state legislature, right? So, like, she should not be our senator
anyway,
right? So, but the thing that also, like, I have been thinking a lot about is that, like, we currently, because of the fact that the vice president was our former senator, have one senator that we did not vote for.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that he might not be a fine senator. I think it's too
early
to tell.
We don't know anything.
He might be great. I know. The one thing that I do know is that I did not vote for him.
Right.
I didn't vote for Dianne Feinstein either.
Right.
However, there's fucking 40 million people in this state. What we don't deserve as people in this state is to have two senators that we did not vote for.
Right.
So, now, like, obviously we're stuck with Dianne Feinstein right now because she was elected tragically. But this is just sort of like a PSA to be like, let's not continue to do that.
Let's not put ourselves in situations where when an inevitably dumb election law in California, listen, all of our election laws are dumb. I'm sorry about it. It's really easy to overturn Democratic policy.
Yeah.
I mean, like the kind where we vote for people, not Democratic, like the party policy in this state. As we've shown here, it's really easy to put stuff on the ballot that does end runs around various legislatures. For some reason in California, you can put anything to a popular vote that you want and then word it funny. And that's totally legal.
Yeah.
And that's what's happening here.
Yeah.
So, like, let's not put ourselves, you know, let's not assume that we won't end up in a similar situation again, because all the laws allow you to run roughshod over the state's will anytime. So let's, knowing that, not elect elderly people to be in the Senate who we have to worry are going to literally die on the job.
Right.
Knowing that we don't ever know who the state government's going to be, because anything could always happen here.
I know.
This whole state is chaos.
That's right. And also, like, elect people who are, like, going to go there and then, like, do things for us.
Right. And remember that we're there. I think an important first step in any Senate run is to have the senator be someone who is able to remember over periods of time
who she is and what she is doing, the things that are happening around her.
Yeah. What current events are occurring.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that she oftentimes is not so tuned into is what's actually happening currently in the world.
The one thing that I do enjoy about this whole thing, besides the fact that it has obviously just on the whole annoyed me, because I'm like, saving everyone from Dianne Feinstein's like death is not, I just like can't,
no.
I can't. But like the fact that people have been acknowledging her cognitive decline.
Yes, has been kind of satisfying.
Has been satisfying in a way that, like, obviously I feel bad for her, but, like, I feel bad for me, too, because she's my senator.
Yeah. I was going to say, I feel bad for people in general who are suffering from cognitive decline.
Right.
I don't feel
bad. They're not all running for Senate.
When people have enabled them to be my senator.
Right, exactly. And also, she has filed papers to run in 2024. So, like, let this be a moment that, like, let's hope this recall does not go through. Let's hope that Dianne Feinstein lives to her next election, because I would like to be able to vote for her replacement. So, like, you know, like, but let's say, you know, we get to 2024. Like, can we please not vote for her?
Yeah, we gotta quit it with her. It's over. And there are some other California politicians that I think also fall into this category that not all of us get to vote for. But, like, you know who else is too old? It's Nancy Pelosi.
Oh, Nancy Pelosi. Yeah.
Mitch McConnell's too old.
Sure.
There's fun for everyone on every side of the aisle if you want to vote for people who are not too old.
Yeah, for sure.
It is not really ever fair to the voters of a place to not be fit to serve out your term when you run for office.
Yeah.
Because the voters have elected you to serve out your term, not elected a random stand-in for an ideology.
Right.
But it's almost like, I think to some extent, certainly the National Democratic Party, and not our state Democratic Party, but many state Democratic parties, really do think that their job is to give you the opportunity to elect a stand-in for an ideology as opposed to a person with an ideology. I mean, I think that's what we have these Senate candidates that we're hearing about.
Oh, God.
You know, we're Abby Finkenauer, like, fuck off with that. Connor Lamb?
No.
Literally, just always go home if you're Connor Lamb. Do not leave your home. Do not pass go or collect $200. God. Like, stay in your home and don't make any phone calls. The idea that these, like, people who are just basically the essence of a human being
right.
are who we're now hearing, you know, who are being put forth as Senate candidates for major Senate seats
right.
is further proof that the Democratic Party is frequently thinking that it is okay to only entice voters with like a vague stand-in for an ideology. And that's what Dianne Feinstein was also doing, because by the time she ran in that last election, she wasn't standing for anything anymore.
No.
She doesn't have any policy.
She wasn't standing.
She is someone who is famously associated with the assault weapons ban.
Totally.
That sunsetted.
Yep.
And that's the last time we heard from her. So, like, she wasn't running
until
on, like...
Until she hugged Lindsey Graham she famously said how great a job he did.
Right.
Like, making sure Amy Coney Barrett became our next
Right, and hearing that she was not mentally present for. Like, this is not somebody who wasn't put in that position by other powerful people with them knowing that she...
Right.
Is offering it. Like, they knew she didn't offer anything. They think it's okay to just give us candidates who are just like suits with a Democratic sticker on them. And like, we actually like don't have to talk like that's acceptable.
Right.
I think,
right.
So often we talk like a stand-in for an ideology is an acceptable candidate for office. It's why people like John Ossoff he's like a suit, a Democratic suit. He doesn't stand for anything.
No.
It's why people loved Pete Buttigieg. He was just empty rhetoric about nothing.
Yep.
And he was wearing a suit. And so you were like, oh, a man.
It's like an entity who has at one point been told a story about what a human is.
Exactly. Yeah. And is like got a lot of metaphors about America under his belt. So he's like able to like really harness the power of the metaphor, but without saying anything with that metaphor. Like these are not who drive, you know, long-term movements.
Right.
These are people that you use to bide time. And, like, let's stop biding time. We're in a fucking crisis.
I agree. Well, and also, you know, you were talking about, we'll just go there because we're, you know, we're talking about Finkenauer and Lamb. And also, you know, one thing that I have been thinking a lot about lately, because we're going to talk about Nina Turner in a second, and these are, like, related in weird ways because it's even related to my rage about having to vote in this recall. I texted you at one point and I was like, when that ballot gets to my I've literally never waited for a ballot so, like,
I know, with so much tension.
So much tension, because when it comes, I have to immediately open it, and I have to fill it out, and then I have to take it to the mail literally the next day, because if it sits in this apartment, it's going to be like the fucking beating heart, and the longer it sits in here, the less apt I am to fill it out.
This is what happened with my presidential ballot. Remember when I had a panic attack voting for Joe Biden?
Yes.
I was just like, at a certain point, I was like, I have to fill it out now and get it out of my house.
Yeah.
As soon as I filled it out, I was like, it has to be out of the house because I could tear it up at any moment in a rage without knowing what's going on.
Yeah.
Like, I agree. It needs to be just like moved out.
Right, exactly. Because like, you know, so Connor Lamb is getting into this primary in Pennsylvania and he's running against John Fetterman, who's the lieutenant governor. He's been elected there.
Yeah.
Statewide on the same ballot,
very reasonable candidate,
where Republican governors have been getting. I mean, like, he's a person who like is well liked there, and he's also, you know, a progressive. He's like that type of kind of like, you know, rust belty progressive kind of, you know, he's like wears like the workers' clothes, and he's like very of the people,
the Sherrod
like,
Brown
stills.
Genre,
right? So, and I'm not saying that they can't have a primary there that should be active, but my issue there is that obviously the DNC is going to come in and they're going to throw all of their weight behind Connor Lamb, who's like an actual loser person.
This is why they gave him a speaking slot at the DNC. I've been trying to figure out why Connor Lamb was present at the DNC in any context on my television screen or elsewhere.
Yeah.
And I could not figure out why he was positioned as the future of the party.
That's our best chance to flip a Senate seat probably in 2022. And so I'm just like, you know, they're going to muck that one up.
Also,
probably.
If Connor Lamb is the candidate, We haven't flipped it, even if we have flipped
well,
it.
Well, I know, right?
So yeah. Let's, yeah.
Who is he?
Let's keep that in mind.
But, you know, also, I think, you know, this happened a couple of weeks ago now. But, you know, Nina Turner lost. And that really has... It took a toll on me. I mean, truly, because, like, I think that, you know, I mean, look, I guess I technically left the Democratic Party a while ago. But, like, obviously, that's the party that, like, if they have a good candidate, like, I'm... It's right. Not like I'm voting for Republicans out here, obviously. But, like, they really... I don't know how many times I can sort of, like, get kicked in the teeth in, like, a sort of, like, very, like, shady and underhanded way. And, like, look, you know, Jim Clyburn can endorse whoever he wants. I'm not saying that he shouldn't. And to a certain degree, Nina Turner probably screwed the pooch on that one because she goaded him into that to a certain degree because she shit-talked him a little bit. So, like, I'm not saying that she ran a perfect campaign here. But, like, you know, obviously she was, like, she was the choice of literally every single local elected official.
Yeah.
The mayor, the Cleveland Plain Dealer, which is not, like, some progressive rag.
Yeah.
You know? And the reason was is because she had done good work there. People knew that she would be a good congressperson. And, you know, everybody, like, started, oh, well, she's been endorsed by Bernie Sanders and AOC. She was also endorsed by Katie Porter and by Ted Lieu. And, you know, like, so, like, they really... did her dirty and surprise because that's what they've
that's
been
what
doing
do.
To dirty Sanders, Bernie Sanders for, you know, two election cycles now also. So I'm not surprised, but that one really felt like that one really felt gross because it really felt unnecessary. It really felt grudgy. It felt.
And they literally threw all their eggs into an unknown basket because no one actually knew who Chantel Brown was. Knows.
Right. And also, like, tons of money, tons of pro-Israel money came into that race.
Right. Like,
I mean, everybody, like, threw their lot in with, like, the closest thing to, like, Democrats have to deplorables to, like, get Chantel Brown elected. And I just, like, I the idea of now voting, especially for congressional Democrats, really just... It, like, I don't know how I do it. I really just, like, I didn't vote for Adam Schiff.
I was going to say, we haven't been voting for congressional Democrats recently.
But I just, like, I don't know that I mean, it would obviously have to be the right one, but, like, I just, it was really upsetting to me. And it was happening, you know, where the next story on here is the, you know, the eviction moratorium, which happened a couple weeks ago, but is relevant again because it just got heard by a federal judge and it was upheld. So the eviction moratorium is going to move forward. But that was all thanks to Cori Bush and, like, her, you know, sleeping outside the Capitol. And I was thinking that happened, I think, the weekend prior to the Nina Turner race. And as Nina Turner was losing, I just, like, I was having these thoughts of, like, what would be happening right now if Lacey Clay was the congressperson from St. Louis. That's who Cori Bush beat in her primary, who obviously the entire
the party apparatus
was always behind, like, Lacey Clay. Lacey Clay would not have been sleeping outside the Capitol. And I'm not saying that, like, we wouldn't have an eviction moratorium without Cori Bush, although I am giving her a lot of credit.
I was going to say, I think we might not have eviction moratorium without Cori Bush.
She certainly gets the credit. I mean, I think other people would have probably gotten big mad about it also. But, like,
she
was the one. Yes, exactly. So all credit to her for sure. But, like, I just kept being, like, as those two things were happening, like, Nina Turner is losing to, like, some, like, Chantel Brown, who's, like, certainly not sleeping outside of the Capitol.
No.
Right? I mean, like, it felt like, why do they care other than that they literally just, A, don't care about us. They don't want us in the room. They don't. And so to that point, I'm kind of like, well, fuck who?
Right.
I don't owe you anything.
No.
Like, screw you.
Like, also,
I'm certainly not giving the Democratic National Party single cent.
No.
Ever again. In this lifetime.
No, it's been kind of nice to know that I never have to give them any money ever again because I'm hoping it will keep me off of some of their lists. Hasn't been working so far, but I hold out hope.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, the other thing that frustrates me about these kinds of elections, because I think that we live in a world where we're really used to seeing, it's like, these big national fundraising operations go focus on races like this in order to ideologically beat the left.
Yeah.
And I really resent when a huge amount, and I realize that Nina Turner was fundraising outside the district too. Like, I'm not suggesting, but when big DNC apparatus come in and throw huge resources into races they don't fucking care about, just to be pills. This is not a race where they were like, Chantel Brown is the greatest thing that we've ever.
No.
They don't even fucking know who she is.
No.
That's not, and maybe the community does, and that's something that her campaign can work on. Like, that's something for the campaigns to work out. But, like, this was not a thing where they came in and said, like, we believe that she will do the work.
Right.
This was a thing where they threw millions and millions of dollars into an abyss, into a garbage can.
Yeah.
Basically, just to avoid having, you know, access to their, to having, you know, to avoid having Nina Turner question their access to their donors, basically, which is like, sure, I get that. That's bad for business if you're a politician, totally. But it's also not good for people.
Right.
It's sort of like how I feel about a lot of the way that the like nonprofit sector works, where it's like at a certain point you become invested in continuing the problem that you've set up the nonprofit to solve because you're making a living solving it. Mm. I feel like politicians do a little bit of that themselves, totally. Where it's like you come into a system that you then become invested in. Because in order to keep your job, you have to be invested in the system. And then all of a sudden, it's like, who cares what the whole point was in the first place? Because if you have to keep your job because you got to keep your house and keep your, you know, keep your career going or whatever, then you suddenly, you know, have to throw millions of dollars into like, you know, random races somewhere because this random congressional race interferes with your fundraising operation. And at a certain point, you're a professional fundraiser. You're not a politician.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Like, I think this is a sign, and we've gotten many of them, but we have to be willing to reconceive of what the role of the party is for the left in a way that I think, you know, the Democratic Socialists are kind of like trying to do, but I don't know that that is necessarily the only group of people that should be trying to do that. We have to be a little bit more, I think, like divorced from this machine,
because I think so too.
This machine is really corrupt at this point, and it's rotting. We shouldn't be in a party that's taking money from Wall Street. We shouldn't be in a party where James Clyburn, who takes money from Big Pharma, huge money from Big Pharma, has the best paid off by Big Pharma in the house, is able to intervene in races in Ohio and decide the results because, you know, because having someone like Nina Turner around is threatening to his money train. Yeah. Like, these are just like not ways that we should be sort of like, this is not a party apparatus that has room for us.
Right. I agree.
And so, and I,
well, and I, th- to
I don't
that,
know what you do.
Well, I think interestingly, I think to that end, at least in a, this is related, I think, anyway, you know, a lot of these sort of like socialist organizations are always, I mean, surprise infighting on the left, right? But about like what the best approach is to sort of like make some of these changes, obviously. And DSA, you know, has taken they want to get people elected, right? But there's also sort of like, there's other people that are just sort of like, screw that. That's not getting us anywhere. Like, let's focus on labor. Let's focus on, you know,
there's things like working families who are endorsing Democrats that are progressive.
Right. Let's focus on activism. Like, let's, you know, there's all these different, and I think you have to sort of like take an all-in approach on that, essentially, because like, you know, one of the other takeaways that I had from that Cori Bush thing was like, that was just like, that was, she pulled a stunt, essentially.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a great stunt.
Yeah.
God bless her. But I mean, like, let's also pull more stunts.
I mean,
you know? I mean, like,
nothing makes me angrier than our lack of stunt pulling.
I know.
Remember when they had the sit-in over gun violence that Chris Murphy organized?
Yeah.
That was fun. Did it? I think we also were like very, like, we're unable to see the kind of cumulative power of stunts like that because they pull it once, it doesn't work, and then they're like, well, failure. But it's like Occupy. You know, Occupy was constantly maligned for being a failure because it didn't clear and specific goals.
Yeah.
But it changed everything about how the left cooperated and didn't cooperate with the political system. It was very impactful, and the strategies were impactful. And so I think oftentimes we, like, because the news cycle doesn't reward failed stunts, we, like, are afraid to try them because, you know, it's risky for a week. But, like, actually, if we were pulling stunts like that, the Republicans are nonstop pulling stunts.
Totally.
And it's working.
I know.
So, like, the week of discomfort is actually worth it.
Yeah.
Because it accumulates into something bigger.
Yeah.
And so the fact that we're constantly, like, afraid to ruffle any feathers.
Yeah.
I think that's why, you know, you're seeing younger people pulling away from the party is it's like, you know, on some level, if you're only interested in the most basic, like, headline driven politics and you're a young person who wants something to change, you want the policy of, you want the headlines of stunts, not the headlines of staid, you know, negotiations.
Yeah.
And so I think on some level, it's not even good messaging anymore to be to appealing to all sides. But yeah, I feel very kind of frustrated about my own indecision about what I think needs to happen to like break this machine. Because on some level, I feel like we should all just try to break it in whatever way seems right and see what happens.
I agree.
Like we should go chaos style on it.
Yeah.
And like in another sense, I'm like, yeah, it'd probably be more effective if we had a coordinated movement, but that's not like us. No, that's not who the left is as people.
It's not who the left is.
And no. I think on some level, our chaos is what makes it hard to divide and conquer us because we are divided and conquered no matter what.
Right.
We're divided. We are in essence divided. So you can't divide and conquer the left because it's like dividing and conquering water. Like it's not, we have no like, you know, center. So I feel like on some level we should be figuring out how to use that to our advantage.
Yeah.
Just, I don't know what kind of chaos style tactics work on this. I'm just like, it's so frustrating.
I know.
That it we is. Continue to allow it to happen.
I know. Yeah. I can't. It's been a couple weeks of like disillusionment.
Yeah.
Here. And so, like, all of these things, like, I read that story about the Senate candidates, and I was like, nope.
Yeah.
And then I'm getting a ballot for this recall election, and I'm like no. Fuck.
None you of you. So it's all like, of you.
It's just...
Everyone's doing it wrong.
I know. Everybody's doing it wrong. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
In any case. Anyway. Thanks, Cori Bush, though.
I mean, truly.
It's like, what hire... a blessing. Put more organizers in there.
Well, that...
She knows what to do. She organized a protest, basically.
Yep.
And that's because people weren't listening to her at her job. Right. She went in there.
Yeah.
Get some people like that.
Yeah, totally.
Who is it at your company that is currently doing some sort of sit-in to get you healthcare? I've done that before. There's always someone, you know. Someone in the office is causing trouble. Put that person on the ballot.
I want to be that person.
I know.
I should be.
You should be. It'd be fun. It's
missing
fun.
An opportunity.
You're missing an opportunity. It's fun, and then at the end of the day, people are like, how did you get away with that? And you're like, I don't know. I'm just really smart.
Amazing.
In any case, so we've extended the eviction moratorium.
Right.
So that's great. Also, a thing that I can't believe it took a stunt to do. This is, like, a simple policy that is going to save the sanity and lives of, like, millions of people.
God.
Like, what an easy answer.
I mean.
Just, you know, and in this, like, they froze student loan payments until February. I have a personal theory that they're going to keep coming up with new cockamamie excuses to freeze it instead of just canceling them because it's easier to kick the can down the road. But again, be uncomfortable for a week while people complain about what this means for the finance industry, whatever. I don't know who is against this, but someone is. Someone with big money is. Be uncomfortable for a week and then know that you measurably improved the lives of millions of people with literally the swipe of a pen, and then you've done it.
Yeah.
And then coast off that messaging after the 1 week of discomfort. Be uncomfortable for 1 week.
Yes.
The Republicans are uncomfortable all the time. They do shit constantly that's like so fucking insane.
Where they just get raked over the coals for like,
and they're just forever. But it fucking works.
Right, and they don't care, right? Nobody, think about what happened after that tax cut, right?
Yeah.
Everyone on planet Earth except like literal billionaires were pissed off about that, but they didn't care.
No.
Right?
And they just...
They don't mind getting dragged on Twitter.
No. And you know what happened at the end of the day? It stayed. Still had a tax cut.
Right.
So, like, they kept the money, and they just got uncomfortable on Twitter for a week.
Yep.
Like, don't worry about the fallout of these sorts of things.
Yeah.
Just do them because they actually improve people's lives.
Yeah.
In case. I have one more rant to go on.
Please. This is...
An article from The Atlantic that was from a couple weeks ago that I just recently was sent is about what this article calls the time tax, which is something that in various forms I have been complaining about a lot because I expend a lot on the time tax.
Yeah.
The time tax is when you try to sign up for really anything that is any kind of service in the entire American system, whether that be public assistance, whether that be healthcare, whether that be paying your taxes, anything. The amount of additional work that you have to do as an American to either do your civic duties or collect any kind of like assistance is so much greater than anywhere else on earth. And we don't measure it, so we don't talk about it, but anecdotally, it's like fairly obvious. Because you know other countries just like tell you how much you owe in taxes? And then you just like pay that much and you don't have to spend hours, you know, researching.
Days.
Yeah, like researching obscure tax law as if you're a fucking CPA. You're not. You should be able to easily do your own taxes.
Yeah.
They know how much you made. So sure let do. Them just tell you what to pay.
Yeah.
You know? And the same thing is true with healthcare. There is no other country yeah. where healthcare is as expensive as it is here.
Yeah.
But then in addition to that, not only do we have this additional expense based on this inefficient system, but you spend, if you are trying to use the healthcare system, 50% of your life fighting with various bureaucratic offices that don't care about anything, that are trying to deny you cancer treatment or whatever.
Right. Yeah.
And that's your life if you're a sick person.
Yeah.
That's I have a part-time job talking to health insurance companies. I have...
Yeah.
spent hours upon hours of my life just like crying on the phone to a health insurance company, mm-hmm. trying to sort out a policy that nobody understands, including yep. the company, even though it's their policy.
Yep.
And that is also not just, that's not just like a frustrating thing because I pay for that service. It's a tax on my time because I'm not compensated for that time.
Yeah.
And I shouldn't have to expend it to yeah. use these systems. But this is also a regressive tax because yes. the thing, you know, all of our public assistance systems are set up so that they are as a deterrent to applying. Yeah. So, you know, we God forbid one non-deserving person accidentally get access to any public assistance system. The whole system is set up so that one undeserving person cannot get access. But that means that millions of deserving people don't have the ability to get access
yeah.
because the systems that we set up to monitor who qualifies are so complicated.
Right.
And sometimes it's like, with policies, it's why we have a lot of policies, even in places like California, that are like fairly well-meaning sounding, but in practice impossible to use. Like, for example, I just learned of this example from this article, but we have free and reduced IDs available oh. for unhoused people, for, you know,
right.
you can get a reduced ID if you make under a certain threshold. Yeah. And, you know, there are a few categories of people where you can get.
Sure. How hard is that to get?
Well, not only do you have to fill out just like a complicated form with lots of information that you wouldn't know the answer to and get your birth certificate, which if you don't have your ID, I don't know where your you have all your other documents, but you have to go to a social worker or a homeless shelter to get the form and have them verify that you are who you say you are. So you can't just fill out this form and get your ID if you are a person who qualifies for it.
Right.
You have to go to a physical location. Right.
You're probably having to take public transit because right. you probably don't have a car.
And this is, you know, for the reduced fee one, it's like $8 instead of $30 or something like that. It's like you have to spend that $22 getting to an office and wasting hours of your time
right.
in order to get...
Time that you were not working at what is probably
a job
that you're being paid by
hourly.
The hour.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like... The cruelty of a system that dangles the idea of like a free or reduced, you know, public yeah. service of some sort and then makes you jump through that many hoops to get access to
right.
it.
Well, it sort of goes to the whole thing, you know, and people talk about this before, but I've never heard it referred to as a time tax anyway. But like it's related to this sort of idea about like how expensive it is to be poor.
Yes,
right?
Totally. And it's a part of why it's so expensive to be poor is because a lot of the programs that are designed to assist the poor are also designed so that you have to be like a lawyer to figure out how to apply to them.
In paperwork filling out.
Exactly. And you have to have like hours of your life to get obscure information from like random sources in order, you know, like to know a lot of random stuff about your income and about your documents and about your background and whatever. Like these are all things no one actually needs to ask you in order to be like, do you need public assistance? Nobody who doesn't need like a couple $100 a month is actually going through the trouble of applying for these programs.
Yeah.
So like,
well, that's their plan.
But their plan is also like flawed because no one who doesn't need that money would bother.
Right.
It's not enough money
yeah.
that you would bother.
Yeah.
And like what's the worst that happens is that someone who doesn't need a couple $100 gets a couple $100, that person likely pays taxes.
Yep.
So like, just don't worry about it so much. don't be so worried about it. But our whole system is set up so that Republicans want to make it difficult so that no one applies because they don't believe the services should exist.
Yep.
But Democrats also don't believe everyone should have access to services. So they endorse programs that are designed specifically to make it, you know, so means tested and so complicated
right.
to apply that a lot of the people who need the help don't get it.
And that's where the complicating paperwork comes in.
It's the means testing.
It's from Democrats making sure that only the exact, you know, people.
Right. It's making sure that your stimulus check only goes to people who make under $75,000.
Right.
What is the harm in a country where almost no one makes any money of just sending it to everyone just in case?
I know.
Who cares if Jeff Bezos gets the $2,000? I do not.
I don't. Yeah.
Because I would rather that someone who accidentally didn't get it doesn't have to go through like 1 billion, you know, reams of paper in order paperwork. I don't know what that metaphor, what that reference was. In order to get the $2,000 they needed.
Yeah.
Like it's just such an insane way of conceiving of how public services should work, and it's the Democrats are as guilty as the Republicans of doing it, and I think we have so much, we have like Stockholm syndrome here, so we just like don't question these sorts of things because we feel like this is how things are. And also, another thing you hear all the time from people who hate socialism or hate communism or whatever is about how much fucking bureaucracy happens in those systems. And there is no socialist country on earth where people are having to spend hours on the phone sorting out their health insurance to make sure they get needed healthcare treatments. There is no program, in Denmark, they are not having to go through this kind of trouble to get public assistance when they're unemployed.
Right.
You know how hard it is to apply for unemployment insurance? Millions of people who were unemployed did not get access to unemployment insurance, even with this boosted, you know, these boosted requirements, because they couldn't figure out how to do it. And you can't call the office because they're never open, and you can't get anyone to help you on the phone. And then if you do it wrong, you're always worried you're going to be sued because all the paperwork says under penalty of law, you'd be dragged into the gulag if you're going to, like...
Totally.
It seems crazy to think about the fact that the like main thing people seem to dislike about socialized systems is this idea that like the government will make you do government. It'll be like being at the DMV always, but like it's not actually better to be at the American DMV.
Right.
The complications of getting your driver's license or ID here are also incredibly high.
Right.
Yeah. So like
for sure.
I think we need to reframe, you know, how we talk about the limitations of our public services in a way that makes clear that, you know,
if they were more easily offered to everyone, that your lives would be easier.
Yes.
Right.
Right. The problem is not that public assistance is inherently bad. Right. It's that they have intentionally made it difficult to access and that you should not actually have to feel like it's your responsibility to spend this much time and become an expert in law in order to access things that belong to, like, if you are a farmer, you actually shouldn't have to have a degree in tax law, you know, because you should be farming. Like none of us should need a degree in tax law to exist in America. No. But like, you know, none of us should need expertise in health insurance law. The amount I know about the health insurance laws in this country is outrageous.
Yeah.
Because I am not a health insurance expert. I don't work in that field. This is just like stuff I had to pick up in order to like get access to medicine.
Make sure that you could get care.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like in any case. I recommend using the term time tax in your regular life, just in sentences,
like
whenever you can. And also to refer to the time you spend doing these actions as a time tax instead of just as an annoying thing that you have to do, because it's actually unnecessary and we should be talking about it like it is.
Yeah, I agree.
In any case.
Well, the next story, you know, we started this, we started our podcast document a couple weeks ago because we were thinking that we might do it last week and then we just didn't end up doing it. And there were a few stories where we were like, oh, maybe that feels a little dated. We'll remove it. You know, that was 2 weeks ago. Nobody cares any longer.
Right.
But infrastructure was on there from 2 weeks ago. And it guess what?
Remains relevant forever.
It was also on there 16 weeks ago.
That's right.
And
doesn't matter what week you talk about. Infrastructure season rages on.
Podcast 408, podcast 308. Infrastructure.
That's right.
Right. It's the thing that binds us all together here.
That's right.
In America.
If you were worried we were on some sort of like weird like time, you know, like time warp.
Yeah.
Because everything's time loop because everything seems weird.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing that we can say has been consistent through this entire crazy period of our lives is Infrastructure Week.
That's right. Yeah. So the latest here is, so they passed the, I don't know if it's a bill or whatever, but they got the votes to move forward with the $3.5 trillion budget, right? Like, so they don't have the votes for it, but like they got 50 votes to like actually sort of like move forward. Now they can sort of like create the like, it was basically like to move forward with reconciliation. So like now I think they have that amount of money that they can play with and they can figure out what they're going to do. Of course, immediately after that passed, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema were like, well, we voted for that, but like, we're not going to vote for the actual bill. So like,
they're the worst.
We're going to bring it all down.
But in any case, Infrastructure Week now has is as it was a couple weeks ago, a two-part infrastructure environment.
Yes.
The first part is a bill that does near nothing and that everyone agrees is great because right. it accomplishes nothing.
Yes,
the second is a bill that actually accomplishes things, so obviously right. only Democrats want to pass
Bernie
that
Sanders
and not all
essentially
of them.
Wrote.
Right. yeah. So that's a bill that was designed to piss off Republicans and all the worst Democrats.
Right, exactly. So you've heard certainly about, you know, the left and Pelosi, to her credit, at least still up until this point, has been saying that she's not going to pass the smaller bipartisan bill until the Senate sends her this $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill, right. right? So, and the left has been, all of the squad has been saying, we're not voting on this smaller bipartisan infrastructure bill until that comes here. And everybody seems to be like standing firm on that right now.
Right.
Well, now we have a new group of people. I don't know if they are calling themselves the Mod Squad or somebody else called them the Mod Squad. That's a quality name. I'm going to give them that. It's upsetting. I don't like that.
They didn't name themselves.
They probably didn't. No. Yeah. But it's like Josh Gottheimer and the usual... The
people that it would be.
The awfuls, right? Yeah. Okay. So they are now saying that they are not going to vote on the $3.5 trillion until they pass the smaller bipartisan bill. So
you can't have it that way.
No, and here's what I want everybody to understand, and I feel like even in the media, they haven't been sort of like fully reporting this correctly, surprise, surprise.
Sure.
But also, you know, the members of the Mod Squad are essentially out there saying that they are doing the same thing that the squad is doing by holding something hostage, right?
Right.
But what they are, obviously, the only reason that they would do this, to say that they won't vote on the $3.5 trillion until the bipartisan passes, is because here's what their plan is. Their plan is to vote for the bipartisan bill and then not vote for the $3.5 trillion.
Obviously.
And there's enough of them because there's nine of them and there's only like three or four votes to play with in the House right now because the House...
shrank.
Right, the margin is very close there. So like that's actually very different than what the squad and even Pelosi is planning to do, because they intend to vote for both of them, right?
Yeah.
The squad is going to vote for the bipartisan bill, even though they don't really much care for it, but they're going to get the $3.5 trillion, so they don't care. So they're going to vote for both of them. This Mod Squad intends to not vote for... They intend to kill the $3.5 trillion.
Yeah, obviously.
So, like, you can't cave to them, because they will screw you on the $3.5 trillion and not think twice about it.
Yeah, they don't.
They don't care.
This deal is inherently suspect.
Yes.
So... there's no reason to go along with their evil scheme when it's a very open evil scheme and everyone knows that it exists.
Yeah.
So but
Pelosi is going to have to need, I hope she is in, I hope the actual squad is in very close communication with her.
Yeah.
Because she's probably actually closer with this lot.
I was going to say, the thing that worries
like
me
these
is
are her
that
people.
I hope that she doesn't think this is an out for her.
I know.
Also, I think on some level, she must understand that if they're going to win the House again, they have to deliver something.
Yeah. No, I think so, too. And
because she has been
like,
firm on this in a way that surprised me.
She really has. I think that's true. And I also think that Biden actually really wants to get this passed, too. I mean, this is essentially his platform. I mean, big parts of it, anyway.
Yeah.
So, like, I do think that they are... I don't think that Joe Biden is going to be told what to do by Josh Gottheimer in this
I mean,
situation.
I don't think anyone should...
Well, they shouldn't be. But
let
like,
themselves be told.
They're too often, I think, letting themselves.
Yeah. It's a real...
But I think in this instance...
Well, and it also goes to show you that this is not like some kind of like progressive dream.
Right.
This is centrist development.
Oh, right, yeah.
This is... What's so crazy about not supporting the $3.5 trillion bill is it's not out there giving out abortions or something.
Right. I know.
It's literally an infrastructure bill.
Yeah.
Everyone is in favor of infrastructure. Everyone likes infrastructure investment.
Yeah.
And... the kinds of infrastructure that it invests in aren't even sufficient to meet our needs. So, like, at least try something. Like, it's not like some sort of like wild progressive policy.
No, it's not.
And the idea of standing against spending that kind of money with the tax cuts that have been allowed to go through in the last few decades is really wild to me. Like, we now know that you can just find the money, first of all.
Yes.
We know. And maybe we'll save some funds on this Afghanistan situation.
Shit. Oh, no. Oh,
but,
boy.
I mean, like, we can find the money. So, like, don't decide that it's a fiscal responsibility thing when the party of fiscal responsibility can't decide it's a fiscal responsibility
right,
thing. Like, fuck off.
God. Anyway, well, that's infrastructure for you.
Yeah. Maybe you heard that Andrew Cuomo's latest victim was himself.
He's resigned, finally.
He has resigned, finally.
Well, although he's still the governor, for whatever reason.
Yeah, he resigned in 2 weeks from the time that he resigned, for unknown reasons.
Yeah.
I cannot believe that this worked. I never thought he would resign, and I have hated him since the beginning.
I know you have.
There is no one who I think is skeezier in New York State politics. There is no one who is more of a Republican in New York State politics. Like, he is the person who gave birth to the IDC. He is the person who, what did he traded away voting reforms for gay marriage. And it's like, look, we all like gay marriage, but one of those is significantly more important. And I'm sorry to break it to everyone, but it's fucking voting laws.
Yeah.
They're the more important one. He basically bought everyone off. But that's why he made that big announcement, because he didn't care about gay marriage. He makes that big announcement, and what we later learned was that was like, he basically bought everyone off with that so that he could kick the can on voting reforms and then not make them.
That sounds right.
You have to make the vote. If you make the right voting reforms, you don't worry about gay marriage anymore, because you just have the law after that. Like, this idea of, you know, sort of selling out the left and center to pay the center right is wild to me, but it's the
Which
legacy
is unfortunate
of Cuomo.
Because now we have a center right governor.
Well, we should have known.
Yeah,
should have known. Listen, she might be terrible.
Yeah,
but Cuomo was terrible. Right. So we're out
she's
here.
Terrible in different ways.
She's terrible in different ways.
Right.
At least we got rid of the first problem.
She's declared that there's not going to be any type of this behavior in her administration, so she's at least willing to do the bare minimum on that front.
Right, and who knows if she knows that how to do that.
Right. We don't know.
She's been working under Cuomo this whole time.
Well, right, exactly.
So I wouldn't say
not knowing any of it was going on.
Right, of course. How could she have known? How could she have found out? It was only known by every single person in New York State. You know, at least we have a female governor and lieutenant governor for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
She's the first female governor.
Yeah.
Like all times that females get to do things for the first time, she got the job by accident. After a huge crisis and a man
after
fucking
a huge
up.
Crisis, right.
After
yeah,
a man
exactly.
fucked
yeah,
everything
you
up.
You didn't mean that in a bad way.
No, no, no. I meant that. Right, yeah. I meant that we right, only right. give women opportunities.
Women only fall into their opportunities. Right. Right.
Women only get these opportunities when a man has fucked up and somebody needs a woman to blame for the fallout.
Right. Exactly.
So looking forward to blaming her for all the fallout.
Oh, right. No, I know. I watched some of that press conference with her, and one of the questions that she got was whether she was going to release all of the, like, nursing home numbers, which is, like, very much a Cuomo scandal. And I was like, oh, history will somehow remember her for that.
That's right.
That being her scandal.
That's right.
Right.
So, yeah, that's why it's better to have a woman in a time like this, because you can really brush everything
right.
under
COVID's
the rug.
COVID's getting worse again.
That's
right.
And that's all her. Cuomo had nothing to do with that. It's going to be all her. And like, look, maybe she's going to be terrible too.
Yeah, sure.
But
she might be. She's been terrible.
She's been terrible
she's
before.
She's previously been terrible.
Right. Yeah. She's certainly not a stranger to terribleness.
No.
But this does seem convenient for Cuomo, because now he can, in 1 year, go and be a pundit and then blame her for all of the things that he set in motion when he was the governor who wouldn't resign.
Yeah. And he would do that, by the way.
For sure. One great thing about this, though, is that now he can't run again.
Mm.
That was the thing. I mean, I guess he
could, because they're not going to
no,
impeach
no.
him.
They're not going to. He could run again. I don't think politically
I don't
he
think
can
he
run
can.
Again.
No, I don't think so either.
And it was really important to me that he not be given a fourth term.
Well, I was going
to
say, he's been governor for too long anyway.
And he's terrible. And nobody likes him. And basically the fact that New York State is like a garbage heap of chaos at all times is the only reason he's been able to hang on to this job. But like, I am just excited about a possibility where we have so much exciting young talent in New York State right now.
Yeah.
We have so many exciting progressives in New York State. The state legislature is filled with all of these really like these like young women and other people from New York City that are like really, you know, like bringing a new kind of perspective to state politics and also driving progressive policy conversations in a new way. And like, those people deserve to have opportunities to move up and to move through the system, as opposed to people, you know, machine people like Cuomo, like hanging on to all the positions of power.
Yeah.
And New York State, I think in particular, has done a good job of building a bench. And so I'm just excited to like get this stain on New York State politics out of the way, because I'm excited to see who could step up and actually, you know, who can step up and run in the next governor's race. I'm excited to see, you know, who politically benefits from his fall in terms of getting, you know, some getting their voice elevated. There's been, you know, a lot of those younger women who are in the legislature and state Senate got real platforms out of this that I, you know, am hoping they're going to use to drive policy discussions about, you know, progressive concerns, because that's most of them are progressives. Like, that is exciting.
Totally.
And like Cuomo just like hanging on for dear life forever until the end of time was just like not what I was interested in.
Agreed.
So in any case,
we got some census data this week.
We got some census data. White people, thankfully, going away.
I mean, the news of the week. Coming from two white people, we can tell you that
we're getting sick of the worst. This. Getting sick
you
of
knew that.
People.
I mean, that's right. I didn't have to tell you.
Also, I feel like anyone who, I mean, these demographic trends, I think, explain a lot of why white people are becoming more terrible. If I had to be honest, because I think a lot of people who previously lived in worlds where everyone was white and communities where everything was just like everyone looked like them and thought like them and acted like them are living in a new world where the, you know, the fastest growing demographic populations now are Asian and Latinx people. And like that means that people's communities are having, you know, Asian and Latino people in them. And like that is a good thing for society.
Yes, it is.
But it's probably driving a lot of this like weird, like, you know, backwards looking, like, you know, rage that we're seeing on the part of the whoever's left of white people.
I know. Like, and only a lot, it's mostly the worst parts of white people that are left. Because apparently we're not reproducing. So.
No, exactly.
But yeah, you're right. I mean, like, it's, I just don't understand. Yeah.
No, yeah. I mean, this, I think, is, you know, these demographic trends are an opportunity, I think, policy-wise, if we seize it correctly, but also could be terrible policy-wise if we don't. I think, like, there is an opportunity to move away from, I think it would be beneficial if this Republican Party was also moving away from their own racist rhetoric.
Well, I know.
I think it would be beneficial if every party was moving away from that.
Hello.
And I think if nothing else, this will potentially drive a slow descent from that, you know.
Yes.
Because it's not going to be viable at a certain point to just be like a weird, ferocious racist and have no other policy. That said,
that's what they're going with.
That said, I hope that Democrats can make the argument that they are able to deliver to immigrant communities, which they don't seem to be that hell-bent on making.
No, I know.
So that these,
well, we lost,
you know,
ground certainly with the, you know, the Latino vote.
Exactly. That's so, I think, you know, these are not trends that mean anything politically significant because we don't know how much the Democrats are going to fuck them up.
Yeah.
But I think it's a sign that the kind of weird, you know, very overtly racist rhetoric that has been part of the system of late is not a sustainable choice even for the Republicans. I hope.
I hope not.
I mean, they can grasp to a dwindling population to their heart's content, I guess, which they are trying to do.
They are trying to do.
No one is talking about the role COVID is playing in decelerating their growth too.
No.
So maybe that's part of it. But but in any case, I also, because the census data has been released now, we have an opportunity to watch the shit show that's going to be redistricting commence.
Ooh, boy.
So buckle up for that.
Yeah.
Because census data is the beginning of a season that is unpleasant.
This was like the initial just like big dump.
Right.
Right. Like, so there's still more information that's going to come out.
And this is also the Trump census, so it's probably a weird census.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway.
Well, it's not right.
Accurate. Right?
It's not accurate. Yeah, exactly.
So that's going to be exciting.
Yes.
And then we have Afghanistan.
You guys.
And listen, we're not a foreign policy podcast, and we don't pretend to be. And we often, we always give this disclaimer before foreign policy news because our opinions of it are entirely formed around the domestic policy discussion that they cause.
Yeah.
So on some level, I couldn't tell you what the right thing to do in any foreign policy situation is other than not spend lots of money on invading places.
Well, right. And not and just generally not going to war.
Just I feel not, like go, I've right. been, not like, going to war is my, like, number one policy.
And I know that sounds like, a, you know, I'm a simpleton, right? Like, but, like, the one, you know, I've been seeing a
it's
lot of people.
So simple that it's true.
Right. People are obviously, like, very upset about this. And I think even a lot of members of the left are like, you know, the people of Afghanistan don't deserve this. They've made, you know, gains in the last 20 years with, you know, like, women can work now and women right. can fucking listen to music. And, like, you know, like, but, like, and I agree with all of those things. But, like, I just, what I want to keep reminding everyone of is that there was never a world, even if you believe in fucking unicorns and right. whatever else, there was never a world where we were going to go into Afghanistan, start a big war, stay right. there for 20 years or 30 years or 100 years, and then leave and have it be fucking fine.
Right, leave it a better place.
That's not a world that exists. No. And so what my point is like, don't go.
Right. Yeah, stay home.
The like, easiest thing to going, do don't be going to war
is to stay home.
Right? It's because, like inevitably, that place was going to be a shit show when we left, whether it was now or whether it was a year later. Right. You don't go into a place like that and then go to war for 20 years and then leave and then be shocked that it's a shit show when you're gone.
Yeah.
Like, of course
it's
it is.
It's like people who are really annoying when they're drunk and are always like, how do I get into these situations when I drink? And you're like, well, it's because you keep going to bars and getting drunk. And then you black out and then you do crazy shit. And you know that you have a tendency to do that. So maybe just don't go into the bar.
Right.
And instead they're like, well, I can't not go into the bar. I'll yeah. just assume this time I'll drink less. Like, that's not actually what happens. If you are 23 and you have a friend who does crazy shit when they're drunk, the only thing that's going to stop them from doing crazy shit when you go out with them is not going into the bar. They're not going to drink responsibly the next time they go to the bar. So, like, it's like the U.S. foreign policy is like this, where it's like, we're like, this time, it'll definitely
right,
be
gonna
different.
Do it right
we're
going
to do it right this time. We're going to build capacity and democracy right. mm-hmm. this time.
We've finally figured out how to right. nation build.
It's only been 200 years of us attempting this, and we finally have figured it out. The thing is, it's going in the door that's the problem.
Yes.
It's the sending right. the troops in
it's
the first
that you
place.
Did, it's not that it's, you didn't have a great plan.
Right. It has nothing.
The great plan didn't exist.
There's no good plan in a situation yeah. where there's only bad plans.
Yeah.
It's, you can't, I remember when I was in Vietnam for the 30th anniversary of the end of the Vietnam War,
yeah.
which there was a holiday with fireworks. And oh. my mom was with me. And we were kind of like walking around in Hanoi, which was like pure chaos every waking moment. And she was like, well, no wonder we didn't win this war. Who would come here and think we could beat these people in a war? It's like everyone is constantly everywhere just like doing stuff. Like no, there was no way our like ridiculous plan was going to work in a place that we had like no conception
yeah.
of how things function.
Yeah.
And so like this, it feels a little bit like that, where it's like we go into wars thinking this time everything will go as predicted.
Yeah.
And we will finally complete our mission to do mm-hmm. the thing we always claim we're doing when yeah. we just like go off to war for no reason.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we get in these quagmires where we're like, how did things get off track this way?
Right.
And it's like, well, they were never on track.
Well, that,
you're
right.
in a place that's not on track.
Well, and that's
the tracklessness.
Right.
Afghanistan's been trackless.
Well, and that's
for
the,
decades.
Right. And that's the other thing that I want to say. And this, you know, might sound heartless due to the fact that, like, it is very bad there right now. But, like, you have to keep leaving.
Yes.
Right? Like the instinct, especially from Joe Biden, because as you mentioned earlier when we were chatting about this, this is the same lot that thought it was a great idea to go there. It's not
exactly.
as if we've changed
leadership.
There's been no turnover since the people who
took
us there
in the first place.
Right?
Yeah.
So like his instinct is going to be to like send all of the troops that he just brought home back there yeah. to like re-kill the Taliban or do whatever it is that yeah. he thinks that he did over the last 20 years that he clearly didn't do.
Right.
Right?
Like, we're, so, like this time we'll figure right. it out.
And so, like, my point is, like, is to still leave. And,
yeah.
like, I think that's hard for a lot of people,
yeah.
right? And, like, it sounds like Brent is just an asshole who, like, wants Afghanistan women to, like, go back
right.
to living a
but
terrible
like,
life. And I don't, but it's just, like, it's not, like, do we just permanently occupy it for,
I was
like,
gonna
literally
say,
the rest
of time?
Are we
the ones like, that get to decide what right. the future of Afghanistan is? And I recognize that it's complicated because the international economy, the economic system sort of forces a lot of countries' hands in terms of sort of developing industries that are destructive to that country
sure.
or developing alliances with corporations that they can't control or, you know, whatever it is. I get that it's more complicated than that, but I also don't, like, we are not actually in charge of how other people, we should not be in charge of how other people govern themselves.
Yeah.
people are up to people shit constantly. And some of that shit is terrible.
Yeah.
I know. I'm not going to argue otherwise. I also think, like, it's one thing to, if you're constantly focused on the short term, then maybe you're like, we can make things a little better right now. But if you never have any long game plan for what you're going to do, or the long game plan is ludicrous, which it was in this case, and 20 years later, you're like, why hasn't our long game plan come to fruition? Then you, like, have to think to yourself, are we the people who are going to fix this?
Yeah.
Sometimes problems occur that you can't actually be the one to fix.
Yeah.
That's too bad.
Yeah.
But you have to admit that you're not the right person to fix it, because us going back to Afghanistan doesn't actually resolve this problem. It continues this dynamic forever.
Yes, I agree.
And has it ever at any point in Afghanistan just been like hunky dory in the last 20 years? No.
No.
It's been constantly under, and this is, by the way, like a trend that's occurring in this entire region. Extremists have been wandering. It's what was going on in Syria. That's what, like,
And we've spent tens of billions of dollars, like, building up the Afghani army and various things, and it's just sort of like nothing worked.
Nothing
worked.
Our point here. Exactly. Yeah. And that's true in a lot of places that you have no business butting your nose into in the first place.
That's right.
If the reason that we theoretically went in there was because we didn't want another 9/11 to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And that really hasn't worked, because we're just shooting each other at this point. So it's like, that was a silly thing to focus on, I guess. But also, you can go in and decide, okay, like, we can take steps to protect the safety of our citizens without taking over whole governments. Right. I think there, you have to think through what your goal actually is in going into a place like Afghanistan. And we can talk about as if it was to free the Afghan people of the control of the Taliban, but that's not what we were doing there.
It wasn't.
We were never there for them.
No.
And the fact that we were never there for them is why it never worked.
Well, right. And that's what I just want this to be the thing that, like, makes people, or whatever it is, but, like,
we're never going to get the thing.
Let this be the thing that, like, makes you become a pacifist.
Americans love the idea of just heading off to war as if we're going to save everyone from themselves.
Yeah.
We can't save ourselves from ourselves.
From ourselves, right.
Exactly. Right now.
Yeah.
Like, we're out there up to shenanigans 100%. And the things that we could do to save people from themselves abroad have a lot more to do with the way that we govern domestically than I think people think.
Yeah.
Because the other thing that would be a huge help in terms of helping stability in other regions abroad is reigning in the power of corporations. It's making sure that individuals are not so wealthy that, you know, that huge chunks of wealth are not available in the economy.
Totally.
It's making sure that because of that, people are able to work in industries that are not, like, amoral industries, that we're not supporting industries that are destructive to the countries that they, you know, that are producing these products. It's making sure that if you want to help a country like Afghanistan, you make sure their economy is not based on the drug trade.
Yep.
You know, like, there are ways that we can legislate that would actually benefit the security of people abroad, that would provide viable jobs and investments and industries for people in countries where the government's always collapsing, and that would bring a kind of stability.
Yeah.
But that requires us to do some things that we are not doing. It's not a military power thing. Like, at a certain point, if 20 years of military power didn't solve it, then, like, soft power has to solve it. We can't, and soft power is free to wield. So use soft power instead.
Yeah.
Like, that. It's so crazy to me that we continue to, like, harp on the idea that, like, the best way to go in and resolve a humanitarian crisis is to inflame it further.
I know.
Like, if the military was just handing out candy to children and didn't have guns, I'd be like, send them everywhere.
Sure.
You want turkeys? Send everyone a turkey. Like, you know. If that's what the military did, I'd be like, sure, we could pay to send turkeys to everyone. That's fine.
But professionally kill people.
They're professionally killing people out there.
That's right.
That's the part that, and that's where all the money's going.
That's right.
It would be pretty cheap to keep a military that just gave out food to people. That's a very cheap operation. Yeah, aid is actually not that expensive.
Right. They do some of that, but not enough.
Not enough. And most of the investments that we make in it, which, by the way, are investments that rob us of resources, because the reason we can't afford, according to everyone, to do anything is not because we don't have an enormous budget nationally.
Right.
It's because all of it is in defense.
We just gave the Pentagon more money this year than they actually asked for, by the way.
Exactly. Well, we're gonna nickel and dime our infrastructure, but we're gonna, give the Pentagon as much money as more money than they could ever dream of. But, like, there are ways to resolve these issues that we think we are going to war over that are economic and that are policy related.
Yeah.
And that is a, it's like we don't want to pull those triggers because then we're imperiling already very powerful and wealthy industries.
It's also harder to think about.
Well, it's complicated.
It's easier to fly people over there with guns.
That's true. And also it's more fun for them because they're basically playing a video game at this point because they're not even over there. They're just droning around. It's true. Just like firing on schools or whatever they're up to. And it's like, it's not actually great.
Oh, God.
But yeah, it's like, it was time for us to leave Afghanistan.
Yeah, and it still is.
And it still is.
Today.
And the fact that after 20 years of investment, nothing worked.
Right.
Is, I think, an even bigger sign that we need... It's sad, but it's also like,
but it's not,
let's
it's
think
not,
of something else to
well,
try then.
Well, that's what I was
going to
say. Like, the solution is going to be trying it again for another 20 years, right?
Right.
Like, that's what people's solution is going to be to the problem.
Exactly. And it's like, what if we tried something else?
Yeah.
In any case, that's the foreign policy expertise that you came here for. It's like, don't go to war, try something else. But literally, it's that simple.
That's it, yeah.
And... you know, beyond that, we'll talk to you next week.
We'll,
I guess.
We'll charge anybody who wants it like top dollar for that.
Yeah. If you need our defense, our defense advice, we're here for you. We care deeply about your work as a defense person. We'll tell you how to do your job.
That's right.
In any case, that's the news this week.
Are we doing a bi-coastal podcast next week? Or
probably.
Are we not?
We'll
Maybe.
See.
We'll
yeah,
see.
We'll
yeah.
see. This.
I was going to New York to.
I'm going to New York
promote
to promote
the book.
We'll see. You know. How my book promotion schedule pans out.
I hope it's full.
I hope it's full too. Yeah. We just don't know anything. It's the problem.
Fair enough.
But also, we'll post links to book events and stuff on our podcast page in case you have any interest.
Yeah.
And, you know, also subscribe to the podcast if you're not. If you have interest in my book, you might want to hear me talk all the time.
That's right.
Oftentimes, we do very extensive research, unlike this week.
Right, no.
Where we just read the news and then talked about it for an hour.
Yeah.
Especially with this recall election coming up, I feel like our bread and butter is electoral politics. That's what we like to talk about. We are going to talk you through this recall effort.
Yes.
To the best of our ability, while also being mad about how we've got to stop putting ourselves in positions where... The main threat of losing Gavin Newsom is that we might lose the Senate because of Dianne Feinstein's impending death.
Right.
Like, we got to do better.
It can't be that.
It can't be that. We'll talk to you next week.
Bye.